Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hello and welcome to the Little Atoms TAM London 2010 special. This week's show features a number of interviews recorded by myself, Neil Denny and Rebecca Watson backstage at the Amazing Meeting London 2010 at the Hilton Metropole Hotel in London on the weekend of October the 16th and 17th. First of all, we've got interviews with Jonathan Ross, who is, well, Jonathan Ross, Andy Nyman, who is the producer of the West End hit Ghost Stories and co-author of most of Derren Brown's TV shows and stage shows, Graham Linehan, comedy writer and creator of Father Ted, Black Books and the IT Crowd, amongst others, Charlie McDonnell and Alex Day, who are YouTube phenomenons, and the amazing Randy himself, James Randy. Following these five short interviews is a longer one, recorded on stage, with myself and the comedian Josie Long interviewing comic legend Alan Moore.
Hi there, what's your name?
Jonathan Ross.
And what are you doing here at the Amazing Meeting London?
Well, I'm here because I'm a big fan of Randy, and I'm a big fan of Tam, and I'm a big fan of many of the other speakers here, so as I said, I couldn't be anywhere else.
And you're also something of a celebrity in this country, I understand.
I'm well known for some good reasons and some bad. For about how long now? Since 87 I've been presenting TV and radio shows over here. And then a couple of years back I was involved in a debacle with Russell Brand, which nearly succeeded in bringing down the BBC. Not quite. Better luck next time.
And what got you interested into skepticism?
I think probably my wife initially, because my wife is here as well, Jane Goldman. She writes movies. But before she did that, she was a writer of fiction and non-fiction. And her non-fiction work included two best-selling books based on The X-Files, but looked into the kind of reality or truth, if there was any, behind the many paranormal events that were used on the show. And, you know, fictionalized, obviously. And in the course of that, she got to meet and interview Randy and Susan Blackmore and Wade Davis and many of the people who are obviously well known to the skeptic community. And that intrigued her and also turned her life around from being someone who was kind of much more on the side of, not only do I want to believe, I'm going to believe regardless, to someone who now says, I can't really believe anymore. So it was kind of a good experience for both of us. And so it's really thanks to her that I'm here, probably.
They're selling the Geek Calendar out on one of the stalls today, and you're one of the people in that. Tell us how you got involved in that.
Well, I knew about the ongoing libel reform case, and I knew about what poor Simon had been through, which is, just sounds about as awful as it, and stressful and unnecessary as something could be, especially when you're just trying to do the right thing. So I was very happy to help, and they just asked me if I'd be in the calendar. Initially disappointed when I found out he wasn't topless or naked, but I swallowed that blow, and I'm sitting at home surrounded by my ridiculous collection of comics and toys, which even I'm embarrassed about the size of, frankly.
It's pretty cool, though, to see somebody who's in the public eye, you know, as much as you are, who retains that geek knowledge, who's a proud, smart person.
But I've always been just really, I've never really been into the mainstream that much. And I don't know whether that's an odd kind of like inverted snobbery or kind of, you know, an odd sort of geeky vanity perhaps, that you think, oh, well, if everyone likes it, it can't be good for me. You know, maybe it's that, because there's a lot of mainstream stuff which I do actually enjoy. But I've always loved comics, and I've always probably preferred weird movies that don't work perhaps, but have a more personal feeling to them than big mainstream stuff. And I, you know, as I said, I love blockbusters, but I'd rather go and see something by Ted V. Michaels or Herschel Gordon Lewis or Ray Dennis Steckler probably than those. So years ago I did the Incredibly Strange Film Show, and that, you know, a lot of people knew that was a work of love, and every now and then when I got the chance on the BBC, and that's probably the one reason why I do feel bad that I'm not there anymore, because sometimes I could exploit my position there to get stuff made that wouldn't otherwise get made. Like I did a big documentary on Steve Ditko, the comic book artist, and that almost definitely wouldn't have seen the light of day if it wasn't for me. So stuff like that, and I'm hoping still to do more of that kind of thing wherever I wind up.
You're actually working on your own comic at the minute, aren't you? So how is that going? When can we see that?
Look at that, this is so cool, isn't it? I've got a phone coming in on my watch. Hold on 1 second. Baby, are you going in? Okay, I'm just going to come and I'm just chatting to some very, very nice podcast people. See you in a minute. Bye, baby. Kind of geeky, isn't it?
It's very geeky.
Yeah,
that's staying in.
Yeah. So what were we saying?
The comic's
going okay, I think. I mean, you know, it's done well critically and it's sold out as well. Looks like you're wanted on stage. It's up, issue 3 is out next week, and I've finished writing 4 and I'm halfway through 5, and I'm also halfway through my next comic series that I'm writing and another project I'm doing with another artist, so it's really good, really exciting.
Well, as it's starting then, we'll just quickly finish off. I know it's radio and everything, so they can't see, but could you explain to us what exactly you're wearing?
I'm wearing an all-in-one black jumpsuit that I bought many years ago and some Rick Owen high tops, and the jumpsuit is... I'm feeling a little flu-y today, which maybe I should have told you before we kissed, but it's very comfortable. You know how it is when a man gets to a certain age and a certain weight, and maybe has a slightly kind of like a high temperature due to either the change or flu. He doesn't want to wear something too tight around the middle. So this all-in-one, and not only is it comfortable in that respect, also it can vent at the side and see a hint of panty, but you see you get a little bit of cooling off going on right there, so... And it's handy if a lady wants to reach in and have a rummage, you know? Who am I to say no?
Pretty sure I can see you for sexual harassment
now.
Yeah,
I think you can. Yeah, yeah. Your eyes are saying soothe, but your hands are saying touch.
Jonathan, thanks for speaking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, what's your name?
My name is Andy Nyman.
And what are you doing at TAM, Andy?
That's a really good question, Neil. I have no fucking idea. I'm a charlatan in a room full of very brainy people. This is where I should be kept. I'm in a little room, little weird room with one chair in it. The interrogation room.
This is actually a trap. We were asked by the organisers of TAM to bring you back here and keep you busy.
Yeah, because I'd let the side down. I think I'm here because of this show that's on in the West End called Ghost Stories that I wrote with my oldest mate, and we directed it and I star in it. And then I also wrote all the Derren Brown stuff with Derren Brown and directed those stage shows as well. So I think that they've seen a glimmer of scepticism in my work. Secret skeptic, yeah.
Now, as part of the TAM Fringe events, I think you gave a discount to attendees to attend Ghost Stories last night. Now, with that showing, did you feel the scepticism in the air?
Do you know what? It was interesting because there were quite a few moments in the show where there are things that the sceptics would really like to hear. And you did hear this frisson of, "Ray!" you know, every time. Were you there? I don't know if you were there or not.
I was there.
Good. So you, on the other hand, you know, too busy squeaking.
I tried.
Yeah. So yes, so it was nice. Yeah, you did hear a sort of, if there was something that was nice to hear. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was asked by one of the audience members, mm-hmm. but I'm gonna do it anyway.
Good.
You mentioned that you work with Derren Brown.
Yeah.
The most recent stuff you've done, you've been doing this sort of like almost sort of meta trick thing, which is that the National Lottery thing where you did the trick and then a week later there's an explanation.
Yeah.
And you can't see this on the radio, but I'm doing the inverted commas,
yeah.
Why have you decided to go down that sort of road?
Well, we've always, to some degree, used that. We've always, you know, from very earliest specials, we've shown stuff and then deconstructed it either legitimately or illegitimately.
Well, I was going to say, normally they're more legitimate, like with the horse racing.
Yeah.
One has a more of a legitimate explanation,
yes.
whereas this was more of an extension of the illusion.
Of the puzzle. Yes. Yeah. And but we've always taken that tack. And I mean, even with the lottery, you know, the extension of the puzzle, we do at the end go, but you know what? It's all nonsense, isn't it? We did it like this. Or no, we didn't do it like that. Legally, who could have done it? You know. So it's that thing of trying to have your cake and eat it, trying to keep the audience intrigued enough without pissing them off, setting the puzzle for them enough that they go and enjoy it, and, you know, some people will go, ugh, it was that. And other people go, no, it's not, because the techniques of persuasion and da, da, da. You know, it's there if you want it, and it's not if you don't.
Since you bring up this idea of not pissing them off, yes. taking them down that road without pissing them off, I've heard from skeptics. I'm so pissed off right now. No, but I have heard, you know, amongst skeptics, for instance, the end of the lottery one was the idea of the wisdom of crowds. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of, Darren Brown has come out publicly and said that he doesn't believe NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, works. He says that's not what he does. However, a lot of what he's done in the past has sort of lent credence to this idea of NLP. And so I know a lot of skeptics, you know, they're a bit annoyed.
They're allowed to be annoyed, but a lot of skeptics are annoyed by breathing.
That's what they do.
I think that, you know, there's clearly, if you're not careful, an argument that you're just swapping one set of bullshit for another set of bullshit. And I think you have to be careful, not you, but one has to be careful, we have to be careful of that, in creating the work. Balanced with what's priceless about the Darren stuff is you'll have the NLP believers going, well, this is the most phenomenal demonstration of NLP. That's why we should teach it like this. This is the Darren technique. This is what he does. And the psychics go, no. I mean, I know some of this is tricks, but you have the gift. It's quite clear. There's no way you could know that stuff. And that's why what Darren's doing there is da-da-da-da. And the magicians go, it's bollocks NLP and psychic. It's a magic trick. And that's why when I'm doing my tricks, you know, everyone, and in fact, a few years ago, we were trying to construct a routine that had an NLP guru, a psychic and a magician, you know, all very high standing. So, because the interesting thing is, it's, you know, it's greatly allied really to skeptical thinking, which is everyone chooses to believe what they want to believe fundamentally, you know. So that doesn't appease the people that are going to be cross, because, you know what, they're going to be cross no matter what, because they're cross. Have a bit of life, have a bit of fun, you know. But that might be very glib, and they might watch that and think it's glib, but yeah.
You'll get hate mail, that's fine.
That's fine, we're used to that, yeah.
Just quickly to finish off then, I mentioned that I was at the Ghost Stories showing last night, and it was fantastic.
Thank you.
I'm absolutely happy to say it was an amazing show, and everyone should go and see it. And Andy, your performance is absolutely awesome.
Thank you.
And if I could say something else about another performance.
See, they're clapping. Yeah. They didn't even see it.
Yeah, go
on. Without giving anything away, because obviously we don't want to give any of the show away.
Yes.
While I thought your performance was fantastic, I absolutely wasn't prepared for how amazing the part that Richard Wiseman played. And I must say that he looks amazing in a parka. So.
No spoilers.
No, there's no spoilers. But last night, it's safe to say, was the first time anyone's even noticed that Richard Wiseman is in the show. But Richard Wiseman is in the show in a very minor but delicious role. So if you come and see Ghost Stories, yes, he is there.
Now, you're passing off Ghost Stories, though, aren't you, in a few weeks?
Yeah, November the 7th, I'm taking a sort of two-month sabbatical to go to New York. I won't be there for 2 months, but, you know, there's a huge amount of interest internationally in the show, so we're looking at our options for Broadway and elsewhere in the US and other places, so I need to be there for that. And Rhys Shearsmith is taking over from me, Rhys from The League of Gentlemen, who's just a brilliant actor and a friend and a fan of the show, so that's fantastic. And then I come back in January for 6 weeks. So
the show's rise has been meteoric. I mean,
yeah.
Tickets first went on sale, weren't they £10 or something?
I mean, we've always tried to price it as low as possible, so it's the cheapest show in the West End to see. Both myself and Jeremy profoundly believe that theatre shouldn't just be for rich middle class people who can afford to spend £75 a ticket. Balanced with, it's really expensive to put a show on, even a show that is, you know, constructed to be cheap. So you can see the show for £15 up to, it's about £45-50 or something.
And, you know, I'll let you go in a minute, but I really, what I appreciate is the fact that you're thinking about theatre in from a different angle.
Yeah.
How interested are you in traditional theatre, or were you before you did this show?
Oh, I adore it. I mean, you know, I'm an actor by profession. I'm obsessed with film more than anything, but, you know, I go to the theatre at least once a week with my wife and kids. I mean, we just go and see anything and everything, just devour it. So I love it. It doesn't mean I don't find a lot of it boring, and it doesn't mean I don't walk away when four of us have been to see a show in town. If we paid full price, you know, 60, 75 quid ahead or something, you're looking at £350 or something by the time four of you have been to the theatre, eaten out, got home. That's a mortgage payment. That's not a sort of flippant, should we get the pictures? That is a lot of money, and that's a... So that's one of the other things with Ghost Stories. I feel you owe the audience a responsibility to deliver something, because people can go and see a million different things, and if they're coming to see yours, you should give them a gift. That sounds pretentious, but I don't mean that. You should give them value for money and give them a night hopefully they'll never forget.
I mean, it was a gift, but a gift that basically would make you shit yourself.
Yes, well, that's what I consider a gift. The gift of shit.
Yeah. You can put that on your playbill now.
Yes, I will do, yeah. It's the gift that makes you shit yourself. Yeah.
Andy, thanks for speaking to us.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
Hi there.
Hello.
What's your name?
Graham Linehan.
And Graham, what are you doing here at TAM?
I was asked to speak about, I don't know, just interests of mine, I guess.
What sort of interests do you
have? I kind of didn't know why they asked me, so I just brought a bunch of stuff and said it would be...
Videos of laughing babies.
Yeah, stuff like that.
That would have been very well. Yeah, I've never seen...
I hope Richard Dawkins was sitting in there when I showed up.
I think he was.
Yeah, he definitely was. Yeah.
So you made Richard Dawkins watch YouTube videos of laughing
babies.
Yes,
I did. That's the victory I'll take home today.
Well done. I suspect you're here because you are responsible for some of the best shows that have been on television ever on both continents I've lived on. For instance, the IT Crowd is, I think, a favourite, probably.
Oh, cheers, around. Thank you. Wow, it's rare that people don't say Ted, so thank you.
Well, you know, I came to IT Crowd first, speaking as
right.
a you know, dumb American.
Right.
And as soon as I did that, then I went to Black Books, and then cool. I went and found Ted.
And I'd say particularly, although obviously for this crowd as well, because Ted's about the Catholic Church, but the IT Crowd is basically, well, it's made geeks cool, hasn't it?
Well, I think there was already a movement along those lines. You know, I don't think you can create Facebook and Apple and stuff and not have cool geeks, really. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it was... We were kind of riding on the back of that, geeks are cool now.
But when you first started, because you said it was influenced by... Well, to quickly tell us again about the story about the guy who actually influenced it that you just told.
Oh, well, you know, I used to get lots of people coming around to my house to fix computers, and none of them ever took, because they were always very hard to speak to. One day, a guy came around to my house, and he knocked on the door. My wife answered the door, and he hadn't spoken to her, and she opened the door, and he said, "You're not Graham." And then he went upstairs, and I was trying to find things to talk about. And I said, "Why don't more people do this?" And he said, "No, they don't have the people skills." So it's like there seemed to me to be people who understood all this stuff that everybody else is totally befuddled by, but the price they paid was sometimes a slight personality defect. You know.
Let's talk about Father Ted a bit then, since sure. we are at a conference that's mostly full of a lot of angry atheists, I think, or apathetic agnostics.
Right.
But what was your thought process going into creating, developing?
Well, you know, we just wanted to write a very stupid sitcom, you know, and the Catholic Church provided this brilliant sitcom trap, because you should always have a trap for your, you know, like the Cheers bar kind of friendship in Friends is the trap, you know, and the trap in Father Ted was that all these people had been moved there because they'd been badly behaved elsewhere, and the Catholic Church used to make a habit of this, moving people on things. So the thing that appealed to us was the idea that they've been moved on so much that they've been sent to a place that isn't on any maps, you know. And so when you've made that decision that it's, for instance, not on any maps, then you can do anything on that island. You can say anything about it and anything about the inhabitants and the people who come. You can just make up the craziest stuff you can think of, you know. So that's what Ted was, really, just us trying to be as insane as we possibly could.
And, I mean, was some of the appeal this ability to be outrageously blasphemous?
No, because we actually didn't do that too often. We had one joke that made a bit of fun about, I think, the, you know, resurrection. But generally, one of the things we got from higher ups was, you can just say anything you want, just don't attack basic tenets of belief. And we did. We just avoided all that. And whenever we were doing that, we weren't really, we wouldn't go for specific tenets of belief. We would go for generalized things like life after death and stuff like that. We wouldn't go for things like transubstantiation, you know. Because apart from anything else, that's all that stuff's a bit arcane if you're not Catholic, and we wanted to have a wide appeal.
You mentioned in the talk that, you know, you tried to avoid the sort of standard sort of Catholic scandals, but you do touch on the idea of the, was it Bishop Brennan who had a secret love child?
Yes.
And there's the sort of the Passion of St. Tibullus episode, which is about sort of like attempts to ban films and stuff.
Yes,
so
yes.
You are commenting on stuff that's...
Oh, yeah, yeah, but, you know, Passion of St. Tibullus was... Yeah, you know, I mean, that could be... That's not necessarily a religious thing. I think the main times when we were really going for the Catholic Church was in the character of Len Brennan. Because
mm-hmm.
Len Brennan is how I see the hierarchy, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a guy, Michael Cleary, Father Michael Cleary, and he had an affair with his housekeeper, and his son was born out of wedlock, obviously, you know, and they turfed him out of the house, you know. This is what the Catholic Church do, you know, and Len was just, you know, us pushing that a little bit, you know, so you see him in the bath with a woman and all this stuff. You know?
So did Michael Cleary also have a irrational fear of rabbits?
No, I don't think so. All this stuff was just basically, something like that was just a way of crowbarring in this rabbit plotline he wants to do.
During your conversation with John Ronson earlier, you mentioned the impact that that Father Ted had on priests, people studying to be priests.
Well, this is what the Guardian said. I don't know how true that is, but it, you know, I'm not surprised. I think it is possible to criticise an organisation through using mild humour rather than really going for the jugular every time. I think going for the jugular, sometimes just people put their hands over their ears. But if you kind of just dance about it and kind of lightly be a kind of jester about it with all the bells jangling, then I think that people kind of are more inclined to take on some of the messages that you're getting across. Although, you know, that makes it sound like we were trying to put secret messages into the show. We weren't really, you know.
Well, no, but there is something gentle about Father Ted Nananda, and maybe because the love for your characters really comes
through.
Yeah,
we deeply love them, you know. Love Ted. To me, Ted was us. Ted was like, you know, a middle-brow guy trying to pretend to some people to be highbrow and just trying to find a way to get through conversations that were driving him insane. Yeah, I love all those characters.
Somebody's just asked you a question at the question and answer session about the idea of making a comedy based on the sceptical movement. It's not really a thing that a great deal of humour could be wrestled out of.
Well, it's because the opposite is so, you know, you're talking about, as I say, you're talking about people who want to say that reality is reality. How can you make fun of that? Do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, I put Scientologists in the last IT crowd because that's endlessly...
Yeah, it's immediately funny anyway.
Yeah.
That
writes itself.
My favourite episode,
good,
actually.
Good, excellent.
Do you make, I mean, obviously you're a skeptical person, and now on IT Crowd, do you make an effort to inject more skepticism?
Well, I would argue that, I would say I'm not a skeptical person. I mean, I guess I'm a skeptical person if you just talk about this particular organisation and this movement. But in general, I'm quite open, and I like to actually believe that people are, you know, that there's a lot of possibility out there, and this world isn't all there is, and there is magic and all this type of thing. But yes, within the confines, within the parameters of science, within the kind of rational thinking, yeah. I guess I do worry a little bit sometimes that we're putting a stamp of scepticism on something that really is just about being human and being thoughtful. Scepticism might be, like piracy, as I was saying earlier, might not be the right word.
You remind me a lot of John Ronson in that regard, because I think both of you do work that appeals to skeptics but is also very accessible to believers of anything and has a certain amount of wonderment to it. Do you think we're shooting ourselves in the foot as a skeptical movement, or are we doing all right?
I'll tell you what I think the problem is. I think the problem is the framing has been set by the enemy. You're being framed as an organization of skeptics, whereas really what you are is, you know, people who believe in science and are excited about the world, you know, and the possibilities of the world, and don't want your thought processes to be muddied up by fucking spurious bullshit. Unfortunately, the peddlers of spurious bullshit are the ones who kind of make you have to call yourselves skeptics. I just wish, in a way, I think it should, in a way, like the way I think piracy should be called sharing, I think skepticism should be just, I don't know, there must be a better word.
Curiosity is the word that I like to
use. I love that word, yeah. We're curious, that's better. Although people would think that means, you know,
bi-curious.
Potentially homosexual, yeah.
I'm okay with that. What are you doing later? Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
Cool.
It was great. Are we ready to do our contrived intro? So we're going to be recording this video for YouTube. Is that going to be okay with you guys?
That's fine, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll be fine.
Yeah. Do you know how to behave when a camera's present? Like, you can...
Oh, I can't help but interact with a camera when it's put on me.
Like, no, I can't help but notice that you're completely ignoring me right now. Yeah. It's kind of like it's like your gerbils, and I can just move this camera around and watch your head spin.
Yeah, I'm like there is a person at the end of that camera watching right. this video at some point in the future. So yeah, I'll just talk
like,
to them.
Yeah, it's like there's a million people right inside this tiny camera. Yeah, or let's be honest, there's 1,000 people. I don't
it's
have
like
any
a million
subscribers. Yeah.
Anyway, hello. What are your names?
I'm Charlie McDonnell.
I'm Alex Day.
And why are you at TAM?
We believe in skepticism. I mean, when Charlie was invited, and I'm his plus one to these things, which is lovely. And
yeah, well, we both make videos on YouTube, and I've been making videos on YouTube for about 3 years or so.
And does anybody watch these videos?
I'm currently the most subscribed YouTuber in the United Kingdom. So
say that again.
I'm currently the most. You've got it. It's fine. I'm not here to brag about it. I mean, that's the thing I have to say because that's just how it is. And I'm very happy about that. Obviously, Alex is the Robin to my Batman.
I think I'm about seventh most subscribed. So yeah, I just do the same thing, but slightly fewer people watch.
Have you considered dumping Alex for whoever's number two? Or is it just like a cat? Is it just like a cat at number two?
That's his makeup, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a girl called Lauren Luke who does makeup.
Oh, who does The Guardian, yeah.
Yeah. She used to be number one, but...
You overtook her.
I did.
Well done.
She overtook me at one point as well, but I took my place back at the top.
Do you think she's as competitive as you clearly are about it?
I'm really happy with looking at the YouTube ratings, hitting refresh again and again and again.
I had a really brief conversation with her once, and I thought this was going to be like the beginning of a friendship with her, because I meet loads of people on YouTube, and then at the end of the friendship, well, what I thought was the friendship, she just said, "Right, good luck with your life," and I never spoke to her again.
good luck with your life.
I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that.
I'm gonna start ending every conversation with that, just to see what the reaction is.
So for the few people in the UK who might not have seen one of your YouTube videos, Charlie, why don't you tell us what sort of thing you do?
I just do video blogs, talking about my life, talking about stuff I'm interested in. I do little comedy things as well, I guess, and lots of music, and Alex does pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
Though Alex is a little bit more life-casty than I am, I guess.
I'm currently most known for taking chapters of the popular book Twilight and just reading it out and making fun of it, which isn't that hard to do and got me a lot of views. But it's genuinely fun to do. I didn't do it for views. But I'm only two chapters from the end, so now I have to actually,
you have to think of another idea.
Yeah. Well, now I've just been kind of sharing a lot more of my actual life, and instead of saying this is funny, laugh at me, I'm saying this is my life. I hope you enjoy it, and it feels a lot more incredible.
Yeah. Talk about the homeopathy and.
I made a couple of videos which were in 3 minutes. The first one was Hung Parliament in 3 minutes, because it was around the time of the election and a lot of people didn't understand what Hung Parliament was, and I did, so I thought I'll just make the video. I used post-it notes with little pictures of Gordon Brown, like stick figure people and stuff. And then I did another one when the series Lost ended, about the Lost finale, called Lost in 3 minutes, and that got like a million views because a lot of people didn't understand that. So coming to TAM has made me want to do like a homeopathy in 3 minutes to just explain to people who don't know exactly what it is.
And it's like Twilight again, you just have to read it and then the laughs just come. Just explain what homeopathy is.
When I first was explained, when it was first explained to me, it was this guy saying, they take a dilution, and so then they do 100 dilutions because they believe every time it's diluted you get stronger. And I said, why? And he just laughed. I don't know why. Nobody knows.
Well, so I mean, you're not known as skeptics first and foremost. Yeah. You're known as entertainers on YouTube. Does coming to an event like this make you want to be more skeptical in what you do?
You can't, not sit in the front row of TAM watching, people like Richard Dawkins talk and not think, oh, I need to do more stuff like this, especially when you're really into it. I mean, what I was doing what I am still doing on YouTube is just what I was doing when I started. It's just talking about the kind of stuff I'm into. And skepticism is something I'm into. A lot. It's not really something I talk about, really. I've done a few things on my YouTube channel which have been kind of more, have had like a skeptical slant on them, but at the end of the day I just want to make kind of entertaining videos, so I made a video deconstructing Heat magazine, which was a lot of fun. I also wrote a song which was a song about chemical love, which was basically me. It was a love song about the chemical basis of love at first sight, so a little bit more kind of skeptical. And I'm definitely coming to TAM, it just kind of makes you more excited to want to do. I mean, as soon as we were on the tube home, we were just like, Yeah.
So many ideas.
We just want to talk at TAM next year. We want to do something that's like skeptical enough, like a big kind of part of this. Yeah, we're just excited.
Yeah.
Just excited YouTubers.
I've occasionally mentioned my beliefs in the videos, just sort of casually say, oh no, I'm an atheist, and so it's just part of another point. And then I'll get a few kind of emails saying, oh hey, I saw you said you're an atheist, that's really cool. Just before I go, look at your fingertip. And that's completely unique, your fingerprint there. That's unlike anyone else. So isn't that amazing? Don't you think? It must have been created. And I'm like, wait, for you, that's a logical conclusion, but for me, that's a massive leap. And the biggest thing for me, is that I think a lot of my audience, I mean, because our audience is mainly sort of 13, 17-year-olds, we have 40% American, and then 25% UK, and then it filters out. It's people that are religious because that's how the world has joy to them. And what I'm hoping is that I can say, well, you don't need religion to still see joy in the world, and if that's why you're religious, then you could consider not being. If you're religious for other reasons, then that's fine. But you know, if you need religion to be happy with the world around you, then there's plenty of natural, amazing things that you could just know about.
Being an atheist is just something I just don't tend to talk about on my YouTube videos at all. I was searching around on Tumblr recently, just searching my name on Tumblr because that's something I do. And there was this thing that someone wrote, which was hotness points, which was they kind of talked about me. And decided, you know, what was hot about me, and, you know, minus plus points, so I have a British accent, plus 50 points or whatever. And they said, religious views, not sure, but might be an atheist, minus 40 hotness points. And that just made me feel, well, I just said,
Reason loses again.
Yeah, that's what I said.
You're not going to get very far with that curve anyway. Though,
and I made a quick Lifecast-y video just kind of reading this out, just because I thought it was funny. And there were lots of comments on it, like from people who, you know, didn't know that I was an atheist, just saying, oh, you're an atheist, that's like plus 100 hotness points, which was, you know, it's quite nice.
Yeah, you've come to the right place now, too. Yeah. It's plus a million. Yeah. But I love to hear the fact that your audience is in that range, that 13 to 17, because skeptics, I think, have trouble because there's so many, for a long time, the main driving force of skepticism and the skeptical movement, if you will, were old white men. And it's been, hi Neil, no, you're not old, but that's just it, as you know, the internet has sort of, you know, that's become a thing. We've gotten a bit younger, a bit more diverse, but we still do have issues reaching the teenage years, because I think it's difficult to identify and promote people who are that age but still intelligent enough and still, you know, with the power to actually speak out.
As religion has shown, of course, it's also a very good age for indoctrination.
Exactly.
As well.
but the thing is, you know, I remember when I was that age and I was busy sublimating any questions I might have about religion or any kind of skepticism. It wasn't until I left home at 17 that I really became an atheist and everything, when I started thinking about things. So, I mean, do you guys feel like you're in a unique position to reach out to these people and help them be more skeptical?
We don't want to take advantage of that position, really. I mean, at the end of the day, we just want to make fun videos. And if they have a skeptical slant, then, and, you know, people want to kind of take away that message, then that's, you know, obviously something I want to be able to do. But we also just want to make fun, entertaining stuff, and that's still our main priority, I think.
Andy Nyman made the point about Derren Brown, which we talked about last night, which was that they just try and make entertainment shows when they do like the Heist and Russian Roulette and stuff, and the skeptical kind of angle on it is much more subtle than you'd expect it to be, because the people that aren't looking for that can just enjoy it as a piece of entertainment. I've been on YouTube for like 4 years. You've been on for 3 or 4?
Almost 4 now, yeah.
Yeah, so we've kind of built that audience up just by, you know, being ourselves and trying to entertain people, and if we just suddenly decided, well, we're going to just talk about skepticism all the time, then, you know, they would just go somewhere else. So we need to keep engaging people in the way that we have and just, being true to that, but also getting across what we believe.
Just making videos that we enjoy, and if skepticism is something we enjoy, then that's something we're going to, you know, want to talk about anyway, really.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Charlie and Alex, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Hi there, what's your name?
Isaac Asimov.
Really? Oh my God.
But I lie a lot, pay no attention to that. No, I'm actually James Randi.
And what are you doing here at the amazing meeting?
I have no idea what my function is, except to show up as a personality and go around and do interviews like this and have my picture taken endlessly. I'm here to, for the first time, to attend a Tam London. This is Tam London 2. I wasn't able to make the original one last year, but I'm quite capable of doing it now, and I'm having a ball.
Good. I mean, your role has also been to show up on stage and get standing ovations.
Well, that's part of the burden I have to bear.
I remember last year at the first Tam London, when you unfortunately weren't able to make it, your video, you on Skype or whatever, got a standing ovation.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. I didn't get any feedback from that one, so I didn't see any image or anything like that. I just sat there in front of the computer and delivered.
So, James, being the progenitor of the James Randi Foundation, of course, and of the amazing meetings, how does it feel to have a branch in London now, and how do you think these UK TAMs are going?
Progenitor, is that a dirty word?
It could be.
Yeah, okay, fine. Well, I'll take it in its best sense then, as a dirty word. It's very interesting to know that we've got an amazing meeting in London going, and from this attendance here, it's just stunning. Every seat, they're filled up the stairways and everything, and they're against the window and on the floor.
I don't think we're supposed to talk about that because of the fire regulations.
Oh, yeah, no, I withdraw that previous statement. And we'll only publish this within 2 years, okay?
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, it's very edifying. It's very flattering. I'm very pleased to see such a good reaction.
Does this herald the JREF entering a worldwide domination of sorts?
Well, in November we're doing Australia as well. It's going to keep me busy, a lot of hopping. I go into airports now and I say, give me a first-class ticket. And they say, where to, sir? And I say, any place. I got business everywhere.
How? I mean, are you okay to travel? People have been concerned about your health, of course.
Oh, I'm quite well now. When I say quite well, I just had a PET scan. Is that thunder, or are they coming to get me with the scythes and pitchforks? Oh, wow. Yes, I've gone through the whole cancer chemotherapy and such, and double cardiac bypass, and I've done very well. I used, what is the name of it? Not acupuncture, not homeopathy, no prayers, no...
I thought we were going to have a scoop.
Oh, no, no, yes, no, no. It's medical science. You may have heard of it.
Yeah,
yes.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Witchcraft.
It's not very popular with the woo-woos out there. No, they'd rather have incense going and things like that.
So no conversions yet?
No, not so far. I'm on the verge of not having any.
Well, we must say, I mean, considering what you have been through over the last year or so, you look absolutely fantastic and fighting fit.
Well, I'm trying hard, and I'm up to it. I'm only 82, after all, you know.
You don't look a day over 81.
There you go. See, you can tell.
Are there any plans to ever say, you know what, I've had enough, I'm not going on stage anymore?
No. I've got to continue on. I think... the thing that's going to interfere with it will be called death, and I'm not anticipating that in the immediate future. No, I want to keep working. In fact, I'm hurrying along. I've got my 10th book in preparation now. That's to be called A Magician in the Laboratory, and it's going to tell an awful lot of stories because, for better or worse, many of the scientists that I'm criticizing have already passed on to whatever their reward might have been. So they can't sue me. But I'm not telling any falsehoods or revealing any deep, dark secrets or disgraceful things. Not at all. I'm just pointing out that we're very naive to believe what they did. And there are many of them out there who are still believing things in a very naive fashion. It's a pity.
This is, of course, one of the ways you got involved in skepticism from being a stage magician, is this idea that scientists are actually ill-equipped to spot when they are being fooled.
That's right, because they depend on a universe that works the way it should. A crystal of copper sulfate, a proton, a glass of milk, does exactly what they would expect of it under normal circumstances. And so when somebody comes along and says they can bend spoons by thinking about them, they say, oh, come on, that's not very likely. Then they see the trick and they say, wow, I've seen the evidence with my own eyes. My question to them, of course, is who else's eyes might you have seen it with? But knowing that you've seen something with your own eyes doesn't really mean anything. It's a hollow statement, because we magicians do things right before people on stages and in private of such a nature that it seems to have no solution.
Speaking of bending spoons in the laboratory, you did Project Alpha. When was that? That was in the 80s, was it? Or
I'm not too good on years, but yeah. It was quite some time ago.
Is it? You know, does it ever get you down to see people still out there believing that Uri Geller can bend spoons with his mind when you've taken care of this subject?
Well, you think you've taken care of it, but Geller only has four tricks. Four tricks? For the last half century, he's been using these four tricks. And he has been caught on YouTube any number of times, and in my books I revealed the secrets of his so-called miracles. He's a magician, and not a very clever magician when you come right down to it. He's learned to do these four tricks. That's a very small repertoire. The average magician has 40 or 50 tricks that are something that he or she will do regularly. But this is astonishing that Geller has still captured the attention of the public.
So what inspires you to keep going when you debunk people like Peter Popoff again and again and they come back?
The response I get from the viewers and the listeners and the people who are tuned in on the internet, the letters I get, I'd say, an average of 3 to 6 every week from people who start out saying something. Oh, I thought you were a terrible man, Mr. Randy, and then I read one of your books, or I saw you on YouTube, and I've decided now that perhaps you're correct. And that's very rewarding. You know you've turned somebody around in their tracks, and you've made them into a useful person instead of somebody who's just stupidly going along and naively going along with claims that the media has made in most cases.
Are you optimistic about the future of the skeptical movement?
Oh, yes, yes. But remember, the internet is a great source of information, but it also has misinformation in it of equal quality and equal volume. So you've got to be very careful. The only change that is made into our way of living and of gaining knowledge is that there's more of it and it comes faster. So it's not a case of improved quality necessarily. You've got to be very careful of that.
James, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and you'll do it again sometime. Maybe next year at Tam London, okay? Or maybe Tam Manchester. Who knows what's in the future?
We'll see
I don't.
There.
And I don't think the psychics do either.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, we're just going to do a short interview with Alan. Before we start, you met me this afternoon, but I'll just introduce, for anyone who doesn't know, on our left we have Josie Long, who...
Hello. Oh, thank you. My only qualification to be here is enthusiasm. But I'm very flattered to get to do this.
Oh, well, that was exactly what my introduction said. So, Alan, you've just alluded to in your talk the idea that, you know, there might be some people in the room, not least yourself, who are wondering what you're doing at a conference about scepticism and rationalism. It's perhaps a mischievous question, but I'd sort of wonder that a rationalist mind would be actually an impediment to the sort of imaginative fiction that you write. And I wonder if you did have more of the mindset that would be expected to be in this room, that your work just wouldn't be the work that most of the people in this room know and love.
Well, I'd say that having a rationalist mindset and at least a flimsy working knowledge of science. I mean, I read New Scientist every week. I could probably bluff my way through black holes and a little bit of string theory, stuff like that. I wouldn't really know what I was talking about, but I'd sound credible and plausible. But it's like, I don't know. I think that, yeah, you need to have a good grasp of rationality if you're going to be a good writer. But whether you need something else as well. This was rather the kind of rumination that led me into ruin, or at least intellectual ruin, by suddenly deciding that there might be something beyond rationality. I mean, which there is. There's irrationality. You laugh, but I mean, Douglas Hofstadter, he did a really great interview in his book Metamagical Themas, and yeah, I've read that. And he was talking about the value of nonsense poetry. He was talking about how we need nonsense, we need irrationality, we need fantasy, if only as the only point from which we can possibly critique reason itself.
Yeah.
And they've got a value. It transgresses all the laws of our world, and it sees what is outside. And if rationality is a system, then it's got a perimeter fence. Otherwise, it's got to have perimeters, because otherwise it's meaningless. So if there are parameters, if there is a perimeter to rationality, then we might reasonably ask, what is beyond that? And I tend to think that you can kind of square the circle. You can look at irrationality with a hopefully rational approach, even though it could never be classed as rationality as the term is normally understood. I know that. Yeah, it's like, well, all of this, I mean, yeah, I'm interested in magic. That doesn't mean that I believe, I mean, yeah, I worship a second century snake god. I know it was a puppet. You know, I mean, like, the idea of a snake with a human head, long blonde hair, lidded eyes, looks a bit like Paris Hilton, and can apparently speak flawless Greek. I know that that is never going to happen. It's much like, I don't know, virgin birth, or kind of ascending physically to heaven. It's just not likely, is it? You know? But the idea is what I'm interested in.
I interviewed Ian Sinclair for the podcast a few weeks ago, and there was some criticism, possibly from someone in the room, on an iTunes review, which basically said this isn't really a sceptical podcast. They were talking to some guff about ley lines or something, and like, you know, Ian Sinclair uses that, and you've used yourself particularly in From Hell, the sort of psychogeography approach, which, you know, and Ian would look at the city, which is, you know, a city is an engineered rational construct, but he looks at it through the prism of magic, and that's is a perfectly valid approach, it seems to me.
Or you, if the word magic is one that makes people uncomfortable, I mean, I tend to apply that to any act of creativity, which to me is the same as pulling a rabbit out of a hat. You're pulling an idea out of an empty mind. It's something out of nothing. So you could use the term poetry instead of magic. Poetry is a very useful tool of excavation in that, you know, you walk down the streets that you walk through every day of your life. And if you kind of look at them objectively, it's probably a shit heap. Or perhaps that's just my perspective coming from Northampton, I don't know. But after a while, you're going to internalise that, aren't you? You're going to think, I live in a shit heap. Mm. Therefore, I am probably a shit. You internalise it. You know, you grow up in that kind of neighbourhood, that will seep into your bones. Whereas, if you are able to walk down a street and to see it with a series of overlays, your personal memories, the things that you know about that street's history. I mean, yeah, this does take a bit of excavation down at the library, but it's worth the effort. You find out about the mythological associations that that street might have, the urban legends, because these are all a kind of reality. It's important not to confuse them with material reality, but they were reality in somebody's mind that is literally as fascinating as something out of a fable. Then give it a few years and you might think, actually, I'm kind of fabulous. And I mean, this has clearly worked for me, you know. I can only recommend it to the rest of you wherever you live. Psychogeography is a great tool for making the environments around us mean something.
Yeah. Adding, yeah. It's like that quote in V for Vendetta where it says, we've got to have knowledge and we've got to have all these other things, but you've always got to have romance as well, and that you need to add those dimensions, and that by adding that kind of thing to your life, it doesn't make you any less of a rational human being or any less of a...
Well, it's just recognising that we do need romance, we do need fiction and figments and mythology, as long as we remember that that's what they are, as long as we don't start confusing levels of reality, as long as we don't start confusing metaphors and symbols with something that like actually happened in the real world, which is where a lot of Christianity comes unstuck. Funnily enough, not Islam. Islam's pretty good when it comes to science. They always seem to think that it was ridiculous to suppose that anybody could have any conception of what was going through a putative deity's mind at the moment of creation. So they understand if there are any stories, they can only be allegorical. And While we're on the subject, actually, because this is quite a pet thing of mine, these fundamentalist Christians, they're nothing to do with the foundations of Christianity. You know, I've not got any axe to grind for Christianity. It sounds, at least, it's not historical. It's a set of symbols and stories which, if you can find meaning in them, then they're wonderful. But that's all it is. And back in the beginnings of Christianity, they were a lot more flexible. There was, I think, in 14th century Lisbon, one of the Jewish scholars there just rewrote the entire creation myth to make it fit more with the Jewish experience of being hounded out of places, of being refugees. So he wrote a refugee creation myth. Nobody was bothered. They understood that these things were just allegories, metaphors. Mm. And it's only when you get this ridiculous literal-mindedness, you know, that, God put the dinosaur skeletons there to test the faith of 19th century paleontologists, you know. That would be a pretty strange god who amused himself by doing stuff like that.
That's quite cool, I think. It'd be quite fun to hang out with. Slightly vindictive.
Certainly. And it would have been, there's probably an even older testament laying around somewhere that's got all the really fun stuff in, like that, you know. Before he grew up and kind of got complacent and started to lose his edge, you know.
Should we talk about Dodgem Logic? Well, would you describe it as a magazine or a fanzine? It sort of strikes me as a fanzine.
Well, it's got a lot of love for fanzines, which is a culture that I grew up with and which they don't seem to be. I mean, you've got a lot of mates who are still into the fanzine scene, and you've done some great fanzines yourself. Thanks. She does drawing moustaches in magazines monthly. Magazine.
Brackets.
Bi-monthly.
It's a very good publication that is published once a year. And
if that.
At the moment I'm 7 months behind the deadline of it, but it's there's a lot of fanzine culture around at the moment. It's really dogged that people keep doing it now in the face of better technology,
yeah,
and in the face of easier dissemination of them. It's like people are like determined to keep photocopying.
Yeah,
them. There's a lot going on.
We're brave but doomed.
Yeah,
you know. It was a few years, about a year ago, 18 months ago, and I'd been working with some of the young offenders down in the Spring Boroughs neighbourhood where I grew up, because I figured that I was an old offender from the neighbourhood, so we'd got some common ground. So I'd been working with them on a small magazine that was for distribution at schools. And it got to the point where we'd been doing articles about binge drinking and knife crime, which, yeah, these are real social problems, but I felt that we weren't really doing our job unless we actually talked about the reason for the binge drinking and the knife crime, which is the fact that it's one of the most deprived areas in Europe. And it's a kind of human skip, basically, where you can just throw out kind of busted people. So I wrote an article to that effect. The magazine we were doing this for was partly council-funded. You can imagine how they reacted. I mean, they just said, well, this is critical of the council, we can't print this. So at that point, I thought, this would be a good time to bring back the underground magazines that I so loved during my 60s and early 70s boyhood, where they did a lot of things that were ridiculous, wrong-headed. They were incredibly sexist, although that was the first place that I heard about contemporary feminism. They would occasionally be homophobic, but again, it was the first place that I heard about gay rights. So in this kind of hit-and-miss attitude to politics, you used to get a lot of interesting stuff coming through. And it was very fertile. You got great talents growing up out of it. So we thought we'd put Dodgem Logic together, and we asked a lot of local people, and we asked people like Jay Money here. Do you object to that name?
That's I've never had it before.
I feel like a rapper. Pretty good. Jay Money. Yeah, it's just great. Robin Ince, and we had Graham Linehan writing a piece in the early issue. We got Stuart Lee, a bunch of comedians, you know, and other writers. We've got Tom Pickard, the brilliant 1960s poet from Newcastle, who did a brilliant first chapter of his autobiography, which we run in that issue. And the first sentence, where he's talking to the great anti-fascist poet Basil Bunting, who fell out with Ezra Pound over Ezra Pound's fascism. And Tom Pickard is saying to him, "Do you think this hash is coated in opium, Basil?" And I think that is one of the best first lines that I've ever heard in any work of literature anywhere. So we're having a great time with it. It's not selling as well as we'd like, but the people who are buying it seem to love it. We seem to have got the mix right, even if we're clearly lousy businessmen. But we're keeping it going for at least a few more issues, and then maybe in another form, you know, perhaps some sort of phantom spiritual form that will just be like a kind of a cold area in one corner of the room. You know?
You'll know you've experienced it.
You'll know, yeah.
But
you won't have anything to prove it.
So, Josie, what have you contributed to it?
I do little comic strips about my stupid opinions and...
That is actually what this one's called. Yeah. It's called My Stupid Opinions. brilliant.
And, I'm just rude about people.
I thought your advice to your younger self, where you'd said, read your Sylvia Plath essay, Blake Morrison is a man, underlined. You know.
That was, if anyone here marked during my degree, I think it probably did bring me right down. And it's just, there wasn't that internet, and I was under a lot of time constraints, and I just couldn't tell Blake could be a woman's name, and the way it was written just seemed, you know, the quote, I'm not proud. I'm not proud. But I worked very hard in other areas of the degree. And, oh, gosh. I wanted to ask you a bit about politics and how you feel about this current government, even though maybe that's a bit broad, but...
Oh, well, I mean, as an anarchist, I obviously hate all of them. And so it's never me to blame, however bad the government is. You know, I do feel... I can remember back in 1979, I remember a friend of mine on the left saying, you know, thank God that this Thatcher woman has got in, because now it's going to be okay to hate the government again. We always felt a little bit ambivalent about hating Jim Callaghan, but now this new woman can be a receptacle for all of our bitterness and hatred, and so she proved to be. You know, I think if he'd known how it was going to work out, he'd have probably not held that opinion. But, yeah, the new government, it's going to be tough. Over this next, I can remember what these people are like, and I should imagine it's going to be very tough over the next 4 or 5 years, or until the next election, if that's like maybe in a couple of weeks' time or something like that. But, and also because we're not given any choice, we're told, well, there's a recession, we almost accept the inevitable cuts. What that means is the weakest people, who actually can't represent themselves and can't fight back, they will be facing inevitable cuts. But there are these vastly costly programs, things like Trident, which if we ever use it, we'll either be already dead or dead within the next 48 hours. So spending billions upon that would seem a little extravagant. So there's always these things that are ring-fenced that we can't touch, and it's always just ordinary people who are going to get fleeced and ground into the dirt, you know, because they are the easiest targets, they're the softest targets, you know. It's going to be tricky for the next few years, but good luck, everybody.
Well, I was going to ask the questions from the floor, but I have actually got the microphone, haven't I, so that's probably not...
Do you want me to run out and...
Have we got time?
Yeah,
2 minutes.
Yeah.
Two minutes.
Okay. So, well, very quickly, without a stampede, if there's anybody who's got questions, can they?
And I'll be doing a little bit of a signing later on. So, if you've got any stuff to bring along, I know that's terribly presumptuous, but if you have, I'll be there. So.
Very, very nerve-wracking walking the length of the
aisle. Yeah, the walk of shame.
Yeah. I had two quick questions. a long time ago you would, were heard to say that you admired the work of Dave McKean. And I don't know, have you actually done anything with him? And would you think about doing anything with him?
It probably wouldn't happen. I mean, because I've... I liked a lot of Dave's work. I mean, sort of... he's an interesting artist, but I am moving very rapidly away from comics. Just because I had a lot of... you get raped a couple of times, it tends to sort of linger in your memory, you know. It's my experiences in the comics business were a bit unfortunate, so I probably wouldn't be thinking... I'm carrying on working with people like Kevin O'Neill that I work with on the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but beyond that, I'm not expecting a lot of artistic collaborations in the future, so... Probably wouldn't happen, but that's through no disrespect for Dave McKean as an artist, certainly.
So my other question is probably quite futile in that case, because you've been heard to say some quite bad things about the Watchmen movie. I haven't really heard your opinion on that.
Well, I haven't actually ever seen the Watchmen movie, because I do prefer to critique things from a position of absolute ignorance. But simply put, it was designed as a comic book. It was written to only be a comic book and to exploit those devices which can only work on a comics page and to show what comics could do as opposed to films. So I was opposed right from the very beginning. I didn't see any point in making that specific comic book into a movie. And from the reaction that I did see... to it, it seemed like a number of people did tend to agree with me. So I win.
Thank you.
We've got time quickly for this last question.
Hi. First of all, thank you for the all the work you've done and the many hours of entertainment it's given me. Sorry to go lowbrow in such a highbrow gathering, but was it really necessary when you killed off Mr. Hyde to not only incinerate him, but show his skeleton explode? Because he was my favourite character. I was kind of hoping you could bring him back.
Yeah. But the thing is, in comics, if you are going to convince anybody that you've really killed somebody, you not only have to show the skeleton, you've kind of got to jump up and down in it and sort of reduce it to pulverised ash and blow it away on the wind. I just wanted to make the point that, no, he's not going to turn up in 3 issues' time with amnesia. Or...
Am I allowed to ask you quickly what you're up to, like, what you've got planned? Anything that you can let people know you've got planned for the future?
Right, OK. A couple more issues of Dodge and Logic. Don't know what's going to be in them. It probably won't be the comic strip about the penis in a space helmet again. I've learned my lesson. I'm hoping to get back soon to my huge, foolishly enormous novel, Jerusalem, which is, I'm about 26 chapters through it. There's another 9 to do. It's all based in the square half mile of dirt that was the subject of the poem. It's going to be about 750,000 words long when it's finished. So, I mean, you hear about those books where on the dust jacket it says, you know, I couldn't put it down. Whereas with this one, it's going to be... I'm hoping that it's going to be one of those books like The Brief History of Time, which everybody's got on their bookshelves, nobody's ever read. So, in some ways, it's beyond criticism. And that's and a few other things. I'm actually, hypocritically, thinking about doing a film. After having railed for 2 or 3 years about the film industry and its excesses and how they're all intellectual pygmies and sort of how I hate them and their parents and sort of... I've just thought, yeah, I might as well do a film, mightn't I? So we're working on a little 10-minute film that might then become a bigger thing. Perhaps out sometime middle of next year. And I'm I'm writing it. I've written the screenplay, and I'm actually making my acting debut as a kind of leading man, which is how I've always seen myself. So there's all of this to come. Yeah.
Cool. Ladies and gentlemen, Alan Moore. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Adams. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleadams.com. The Little Adams podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.